Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
I think we are ready to begin tonight's program, and ladies and gentlemen, I am especially pleased tonight to introduce someone who, in this crowd, really does not need much of an introduction. But I bet you're wondering how someone who was born in Cuero, Texas, arrives a few years later, give or take a few decades, ended up in Riyadh as ambassador. But first, I think we need to focus on someone who's very special, and that's Jim's bride, Anita. Anita, thank you for being with us. Please stand so everybody can see you. No doubt about it, the Oberwetter ambassadorship was indeed a partnership. In fact, Jim had to get, frankly, an act of Congress to allow Anita to play the vital role that she played over the 3 years that Jim was ambassador. Because as he said, I need to know what 50% of the population is thinking. And Anita certainly did that for him. In late 2003, Jim called me and he asked if I would be a reference for a security clearance. I thought that was quite something. And he said, for a possible position with the administration. And you know, I said, well, on one condition. Well, first I said, what is the position? He says, I can't tell you that now, but use your brain. You might be able to figure it out. And I said, I'll give you a good security clearance on one condition, and that is that you speak for the World Affairs Council. And isn't that true? It's true. See, I can be bought. So when the FBI called, we talked, and I said this was probably a pretty easy assignment, vetting Jim Oberwetter. And he said, you know, that's really the truth. Rarely has he ever worked on a case where someone was so respected and so admired, and even Aggies were giving that Longhorn rave reviews. And I said to the security agent, and I won't use his name, I said, I bet Mr. Oberwetter will be a really good ambassador in Saudi Arabia. And he said, you know, I think he will be too. But I never released that information. You know, about 35% of our ambassadors are appointed by the president. Some pack up their families, and you know, you can imagine they go home to their bride and say, guess what, we're going to the Bahamas, and there's this wonderful happiness. Or they say, wouldn't you like to be the first lady of the residence in St. James or Élysée in Paris? And I know we'll have to dig deep into our pockets, but that's why we've worked at Hunt for all these years. And that's not what Jim said. Jim said, we're going to Riyadh. A side note, when I was married 28 years ago to my wife, she wrote in the vows, but we didn't actually say them. She just sort of mouthed them. I will follow you anywhere in the world except Riyadh. There's something really important to know, though, about Jim Oberwetter, and that is that he was not angling for an ambassadorship. I know Jim very well, and this was the farthest thing from his mind. He always wanted to serve the country. He wanted to serve the president, but he was not looking to be an ambassador. And Jim had been at Hunt for nearly 30 years. He's recently married to Anita. His children were graduating, getting wonderful jobs around the country. And so it really was a complete surprise when he was invited to the White House, which he often was, but on a routine visit. And then they said, why don't we walk over to the Oval Office? Someone wants to talk with you. Jim brought to the position a myriad of qualifications. He was at the time, as I mentioned, with Hunt Consolidated, where he was Senior VP of Government and Political Affairs. And prior to this, this is an interesting part of the Oberwetter story, he was, in the beginning of his career, Press Secretary for President George H.W. Bush, and maintained a very close relationship with the President. He knew the area, the Gulf region. He knew the kingdom because at Hunt, as some of you know, the Hunt Company had been very involved in Yemen. And Jim had worked for many years as a volunteer with the American Petroleum Institute. When Bob Jordan, who is also from Texas, had served with distinction as our ambassador, was ready to come home, it was quite clear and not surprising that the president didn't have to go very far to select his new ambassador. Jim Oberwetter is someone who listens, he challenges, but he also builds consensus. and he always treats others with respect and empathy. No doubt these are traits that served him extremely well. Just several months ago, I was talking to now our current ambassador, Saudi Arabia's current ambassador, Adel Al-Jabir, who happens to be a graduate of the University of North Texas, just up the road. And he said, the kingdom was indeed fortunate to have Jim Oberwetter's leadership during such a critical period. Since returning to the States, Jim has launched Oberwetter & Company, and this is a consulting firm that concentrates on helping companies with strategic public affairs issues and also issues pertaining to trade, defense, and healthcare. We are especially grateful to have Jim and Anita home safe. We owe them much for their service. Please welcome our good friend, Ambassador Jim Oberwetter.
Jim, thank you very much. I assume you can hear me. Is this microphone on? I've got a lavalier and I can't hear it. No? Now is it on? Is this? No? Okay. I was promised that this would work. Now we go. Okay. Jim, thank you very much for those very humorous remarks. I don't know where you come up with your material, but it's much appreciated. It is so good to be here in Fort Worth. Let me just say, it's not. It's terrific to be here in Fort Worth. We are glad to be home. I am so pleased that kind of our initial speech, if you will, about the experiences we had in Riyadh will be delivered here in Fort Worth. I want to thank all of you for coming tonight, taking time from busy schedules. I want to thank the sponsors of this event, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Chamber of Commerce, Sister Cities, and special thanks to Pat Patterson, who heads the council, to the Estradas for being here with us tonight. Bob, good to see you all. Gene, nice to visit with you at the table tonight and come to know Fort Worth a little bit better through you. We had a terrific time in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and it's true what Jim said. Anita made life easier, and since there are about half of the people that I cannot interact with, she was my eyes and ears and helped the thinking process evolve with respect to many of the issues facing the women of Saudi Arabia. And she was terrific as the ambassador and ambassador's wife and resident at Quincy House. So you really did get a two for the price of one when we got to go over to Riyadh. I thought what I would do tonight is explain to you a little bit about that mission. Talk about first the context of where the country is in the region, then address how that country is performing and why it's so important to us in the United States, and talk a little bit about where we're going. It's a lot of territory to cover. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram had asked me to do an article, which many of you may have seen over the weekend, that explains in great detail how we went about doing our business. But it was an experience, obviously, of a lifetime, where I was able to put a career in politics that spans, I don't know, Pierce, how long has it been, 35 years or so, in the making, and found what Jim Baker did, that the Texas political experience translates very nicely to international political affairs. Thank you very much. It's quite amazing. Let me begin with a little bit of context setting. In a book entitled Diplomacy, the author posits three lessons that were learned in hopes that American conflicts in the future would result in successful outcomes. First, the author said, before America commits itself to combat, it should have a clear understanding of the threat and of the objectives that it can achieve. It must have a clear military strategy and an unambiguous definition of what constitutes a successful political outcome. And second, there can be no alternative to victory, and this requires careful elaboration of political goals and military strategy so as to achieve those before the decision to go to war. And third, a democracy cannot conduct serious foreign policy if the contending factions within that democracy do not exercise restraint towards one another. When the war, about which the author wrote and described as morally ambiguous, ended, and in which America's material superiority was largely irrelevant, America found it was at odds with itself. I know that by this time many of you have recognized who the author of that book, Diplomacy, was, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. His lessons in the chapter entitled Vietnam, the Extrication, reverberate very loudly today. That war ended badly. The consequences were quite severe in Vietnam and Cambodia. And while the domino theory that we have all heard about did not come to pass for all of the nearby countries, the Soviet Union did see our weakness at that time and began to make bold moves around the world. Finally, that country entered Afghanistan, where it suffered a disaster which helped topple its overarching regime. The Islamic extremists of today take as an article of faith that they caused that Soviet defeat to happen, not just in Afghanistan, but they believe that in a greater sense, they destroyed the center of communism. We should understand that the extremists who take their violent theories from Sayyid Qutb in his book Milestones view communism and capitalism through the very same set of reading glasses. They see it just as different economic structures, but both, they believe, will fall and thus prove their point that no system, no economic system or otherwise, will prevail against their deviant brand of Islam. Sayyid Qutb's brother was the teacher of Osama bin Laden. As for the Russians today, one should be sensing a certain reminiscent assertiveness, which is most apparent at this time, as they did before when we were not projecting our greatest strengths. They are prone to look for advantages when we are focused very narrowly. We cannot focus on countries narrowly. We must view and understand countries in the framework of their historical imperatives of their regions and of their peoples. And while the outcome tonight of Iraq is in the balance, it is clear that the United States has already dramatically changed the dynamics of the Middle East. Has it changed for better or for worse? There is no good answer to that question at this time. The verdict is pending, but the political plate tectonics are moving. We need now to begin to fully and accurately assess those changes that are going on at this time. We need then to think strategically, make well-informed policy judgments, and not hesitate to take strong diplomatic action or other action if diplomatic action fails, if we are to protect our interests and our allies in the region, but especially our country in particular. We have troubles in Iraq, and Iran is rising. And so it appears tonight that our diplomacy, which we've worked hard on at the United Nations, may not lead to additional sanctions against Iran. If that is true, then our leadership will face grave choices as to whether or not Iran will be allowed to have nuclear weapons. The president, I hope, will look for advice widely within the U.S. and with our allies, with the United States Congress, and with others who can play a role, to carefully chart the course of action that will remain, especially if that course is limited to war. The diplomatic doors that we have, even if not used, must remain open in the event that the Iranians come to a conclusion that a solution like the one found by Libya, and perhaps the one that the North Koreans are finding now, are an alternative course to action and an attractive alternative course. Neither Saudi Arabia nor any country in the region, perhaps no country in the world, is immune to the consequences, intended or not, of the outcome in Iraq, because Iran has overreaching ambitions for the region. Saudi Arabia will play a key role in this changed Middle East. Before I move to our bilateral relationship there, there are a few facts that I want to give you that will help put that country into context. As I said, you need to view every region and every country in context, so you have something of a tactile feeling of the place. I would say at this point, Pat Patterson came to visit us. We took her to a little camel farm out near Jeddah, where there were some tactile feelings being expressed by the herd leader. And she saw, I would say, a part of Saudi Arabia that perhaps no one else in this room ever has. Saudi Arabia, the home of Islam and Mecca and Medina and their required Hajj. Homeland Security, boy, do they have people coming in from all over the world every year, unbelievable numbers. A vast desert in an unconquered central plain, the Najd area, that never saw a colonial power in place, where church and state are united, where the students that I met with that are college teacher students, teaching students that are going to be the teachers in colleges and universities, argue forcefully that their unitary system is the right form of government and that we have it wrong, where Muhammad Wahhab and the original Al Saud founder consummated this marriage of church and state in the desert in 1744, where 265 billion barrels of oil still await production, and that production has lifted what was a nomadic country only 50 years ago into a middle-class oil-driven state, where, contrary to myth, women can be very successful in business, as lawyers, as doctors, as deans and academics, and all of the rest if the patriarch allows, where women outnumber the men in colleges and universities. Sounds familiar here. Where women drivers are not blamed for the huge number of traffic accidents that they have in that country for some obvious reasons, but that counter to the thinking of most of us in the West, the women do not list that issue high on their list of things to do or as great achievements. They care more about their families and how their kids are growing up. It is certainly true that the women of the kingdom are beholden to the men of the family, and the women cite tribal customs much more often than their religion as the reason for that. Not Islam, but tribal customs. where one unexpectedly finds the members of the royal family as the force to promote change, not to hold the country back, albeit slow change, where the clerics and the tribal leaders and most of the citizens of the country are anchored in traditional and old ways, where religion is the dominant construct of the place, almost its reason for being these days, not oil, and where they pray five times a day, many of them, in the 70,000 mosques of Saudi Arabia, where 45% of the population is under 18, and where between 13 and 25% of the young male population is unemployed, where Starbucks coffee shops overflow with these young men. It's a great street scene, but they're all dressed in white. You know, the women are dressed in black, the guys are dressed in white. And Anita tells me that the family section, where the women go in these cafes and shops, are seeing just as much business from the women. Where freedom of assembly, that is, meetings without the permission of the government, are not allowed. Where so many TV satellite dishes abound illegally that the Commission for the Prevention of Vice and the Protection of Virtue has simply thrown up its hands to acquiesce in this cultural shift to new cultural norms. I was told on arrival that the commission used to shoot those satellite TV dishes, but there are no longer enough bullets to go around. Huge changes are taking place. We don't see them, we don't understand them, they're glacial to us, but for that culture that's just out of the desert, it's monumental. And cultural shifts occur in these strange ways. The press actually reports very hard news. It's not freedom of the press, but it's better than most of the other press anywhere in the Middle East. There are certain lines that they don't cross, like criticism of the royal family. But where weddings are arranged by families, often in keeping with tribal social standing, but where the Grand Mufti declared forced marriages illegal in 2005, where half of all the Saudi marriages end in divorce, where country borders are now delineated, but the Bedouin spirit remains essential to their being, which is why many of my meetings occurred after midnight. And this spirit is very much akin to the spirit of the West, which is so meaningful to us here in America, where the culture of tribes and tribal territories matter just like the laws of Sharia do, and the power of shame and the power of honor as legal concepts that they use. Often these concepts handed down from the Quran, the word of God, not man-made laws, therefore. Where the leadership of Al-Qaeda in the form of bin Laden was born and educated, as I said, by the brother of Saeed Qutb, who attacked the Saudi regime, lost his citizenship in 1994, and fled to do horrid things against the civilized peoples of the world. And where Iraq, if it goes the wrong way, threatens the Saudis, they believe, in two different ways. First, by the Al-Qaeda elements returning from Iraq to launch attacks upon the government. And secondly, by a more aggressive Iran, which is in the process of establishing a nuclear weapons program. Wow. What a country. What a challenge it was to serve, and especially at this time in the Middle East. In the month that the president asked me to serve, Time served up the following headline on its cover: "The Saudis, whose side are they on in the war on terror?" Well, I looked at that and thought to myself that I hope I know the answer to that question, because I'm just about to find out in person. And shortly afterwards, Newsweek's cover said, "Is Saudi Arabia doomed?" This reflected the mentality in 2003, at the end of it, in early 2004, when Anita and I went to Saudi Arabia. And remember, too, that some were saying at that time, after 9/11, that with respect to our attack on Iraq, we actually had bombed the wrong country, and they were meaning it should have been Saudi Arabia. This was the milieu into which this new non-career ambassador arrived. I thought that I knew the answers to these questions instinctively, but after 3 years of service there, we've answered these questions fully. In the first year, it was a tough one of bombings and beheadings, of killing and attack on our consulate, where we lost some workers, third country nationals. Saudi Arabia got much better, and I mean it, and I put this in context. If you ever meet someone who says that things cannot get worse in the Middle East, mark them down as knowing nothing about the place. Things can always get worse in the Middle East. But in Saudi Arabia, things got better. And the question is, why did things get better in Saudi Arabia when so many in our government and so many in nearby country governments thought that they were in deep trouble, if not finished? I think there are three reasons that will explain it. First, the importance of the relationship to Saudi Arabia and the world, and to us. It is a strategic one that is growing in importance rather than diminishing. A little counterintuitive to some. As Iraq's troubles begin to boil over into nearby countries, and with the rise of a hostile Iran, we need to find friends in the region, and we need big friends in the region, that the Saudis do too. And thus, real need has necessitated a realigned relationship. And the Saudi government sees our struggles in Iraq, but it finds no pleasure in those struggles that we're having in Iraq. It knows that it, Saudi Arabia, has to prepare for the day, sooner or later, that the U.S. will not be next door in Iraq. And this troubles them greatly. They must be stronger when the U.S. retires from the field. And thus, the recently announced weapons deal that has caused some consternation in certain quarters must go through. Have you noticed lately that usual objections from other allies that we have in the region have all but vanished? There's a reason for that, because the Middle East has changed and the old paradigms are giving way to new ones. Under forward-looking leadership of King Abdullah, he's like 82 or 83, and we're saying forward-looking leadership. And he's, I must say, a very nice, thoughtful guy, and visionary too. They are slowly but surely making the internal significant changes and beginning to engage at a faster pace globally in diplomatic ventures. In Iran, which you hear me talking about a lot because it's meaningful to the situation right now, was playing diplomatic chess almost alone as a regional power about 2 years ago, and now they find the Arabs in the form of the Saudis competing with them on the playing field in the Middle East with thoughtful and very deliberate diplomatic moves. Internally, the Saudis have done the heavy lifting that they need to do to improve their security at home. How did they do that? They used what came naturally to them, their culture, their families, and nuclear families, their clans, their tribes, their religions, to vastly diminish Al-Qaeda's infrastructure and its capabilities in that country. They recognize that this will be a long fight, and all of us have to recognize this will be a long fight. The king told me perhaps decades, but they are engaged in the fight on many fronts, and discreetly and quietly, in ways that both of our two countries agree will be helpful. The United States of America plays a very important role behind the scenes in assisting them with counterterrorist activities. It's so strategically important, and that's why we must invest the time and energy there. Its energy supplies are important to the world. Its holy cities make it the seat of Islam. It occupies an important position along two narrow and very important seas. It has great influence throughout the Arab world. And of late, a fifth and very significant reason for our strategic engagement, and that is the fight against terrorism. On arrival, the Saudi foreign minister, a Princeton guy, by the way, Foreign Minister Prince Saud Al-Faisal, who's been in that office for more than 30 years, told me at an early time, from their perspective, the relationship between our two countries was simply drifting. And it was. Osama bin Laden had chosen 15 of 19 of those who attacked us to come from Saudi Arabia. He hoped by doing that it would hurt us, break the relationship, bring down the ruling family, and give him an oil-rich nation by which to use his insidious devices against the world. And the Saudis were never our most popular ally for many of the reasons that we all know. They fell further from grace, even though they had stripped bin Laden of his citizenship in 1994. A strategic relationship that is drifting is not a good thing. And it was President Franklin D. Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz who cemented the relationship in the beginning in person. But it's not acceptable for it to drift in a volatile Middle East. And thus, when I heard the foreign minister tell me that, I directed the U.S. Embassy team to prepare a plan that would recommend strategic repositioning of our relationship to make it an effective one. And of course, the first question was, what should the relationship be, given that 9/11 had changed it so dramatically? At the same time we went to work, our colleagues in Saudi Arabia in the Foreign Office went to work. We proposed specific steps to Washington addressing what a rejuvenated relationship should be. This proceeded through the usual route, the NEA Bureau and the State Department, and then through deputies of various agencies reviewing the suggestions, then to the principals of our government reviewing these suggestions, valuable additions being made by key players in Washington, including David Welch, the Assistant Secretary for the Near East, who proposed a series of strategic talks so we could constantly be in contact with one another. That was added to the plan. Other elements strengthening the military-to-military relationship, heightening the counterterrorism activities and cooperation, addressing consular issues that were a huge and still remain huge headache, talking about human rights for the first time between the two countries, strengthening our economic ties, increasing visas for Saudi students to come to the United States to be educated in Western universities and colleges, rather than to have the experience of their own college and university system that is heavily tilted to Islamic studies. And with final approval of the plan, the President and the Crown Prince announced many of its elements during their meeting in 2005 in Texas in Crawford. And since that time, there has been a spirit of openness and candor between our two governments. It prevails today, and often you will find Secretary of State Rice meeting with the Foreign Minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, during these strategic talks that are now in place. That was a rather long first point, so on the second and third, I won't go into so much detail. But this is the internals of Saudi Arabia. Predominantly Sunni, of their own volition, even prior to 9/11, but certainly since then, they had begun to address fundamental internal questions they had never talked about publicly, and to act on them. They held national dialogues on a variety of subjects, including the other. Unless you're Muslim with us tonight, you are the other. And they discussed this on national television. And they have set up meetings in 13 or 14 of the cities before they all come together in convocation to try to address the other and tolerance. Dialogues on women, the role of women in their society, the role of others, for instance, Shia, in their society. A huge international counterterrorism conference was held. Anita and I both witnessed in the public school system what was being taught as an anti-terrorist appeal, making sure that the children understood they should stay away from the deviance of Islam, as they're referred to. Secret programs, some of which were just revealed on CNN last week by the Saudis, but that have been underway for more than 3 years to rehabilitate young people away from the deviant views of those who are in Al-Qaeda. And they have particular processes that they use to accomplish their methods. I have some superb psychologists and PhDs in psychiatry who help them address all of these issues. Nationwide television campaigns promoted to help the citizens get involved in turning in terrorists, publishing lists of terrorists, three different lists of terrorists that went from like 30 in one to 40 in another to another 30, of known terrorist suspects with their photos in the newspaper. All but a very few of these people are gone. They've bit the dust, dead or arrested and in jail. This is key because the publishing of someone's photograph in a newspaper in Saudi Arabia and listing them as a bad guy, unless you've lived there, you don't understand what damage can be wrought to the honor of a family. So for them, these are unbelievable things that are happening as they grapple with the issue of terrorism. And to have these 90 pictures of people in the newspaper, it was unheard of when we got there. Unheard of. Internationally, the Saudis have put a peace plan on the table regarding Israel and the Palestinians. And they reissued that at the Arab League meeting. It was the last function I attended before getting on the airplane. It's a very imperfect plan. But the key word is peace. And the Saudis were the ones that introduced it. And this is not a word that one hears, for example, from Iran in reference to Israel. So there are dramatic things that are happening within that kingdom that do not register here. Part of the job of the embassy is to make sure, at least with those of influence in our government, they are exposed to these changes so they can make well-informed decisions about what's happening on the ground. And the Saudis stepped up during the Lebanese conflict last summer in ways that the Lebanese appreciated, even if the Syrians didn't and the Iranians didn't. And they tried in Mecca to stop the violence between the warring Palestinian factions, and they stopped it for a while, but not for good. And their assertive views on the diplomatic front, we must come to accept, will not always be in lockstep with America's. They live in the neighborhood, and their views will be different than ours. They have concluded, and they've told our most senior leadership in person and in public 6 months later, that they believe that our moves in Iraq have shifted that country's political orbit towards Iran, Shia Iran, although they are careful not to use the secular terms, preferring to address it as Arab and Persian, drawing distinctions in some other ways to try to capture more of popular appeal in Iraq. They now think that Iran's effectively extended its influence to the Saudi border. They know we will leave, as I said before, at some point sooner or later. And they'll have a new neighbor that they need to deal with. So they're going to be helpful to us in Iraq when they view it as not harmful to their national interests. And there are many ways that they can be of help. They have taken steps, as many as they can, but you can always do more, is what our government says, and that's what I always said. There's more to be done. To prevent jihadis from going to Iraq across the Saudi border. First, it's a huge desert, and it is very hard to do. Second, they have 35,000 troops along the border. So effective have they been at sealing their border that the young Saudis that are intent on committing jihad get on airplanes under false pretenses and fly to other countries, go into Syria, and that's what you see on the news. That's what's happening today. So effectively, they've sealed their border. It's not 100%. I don't know any large country that can do that. But they're trying. They are trying. And they deserve credit when they're trying, instead of clubbing around on some of the talking head shows, where I'm amazed at how little people actually know about the region. We know, our government knows, that the Saudis have complained relentlessly to us that there are no Iraq border guards on the other side to stop illegal entries coming back the other way. Maybe those returning al-Qaeda jihadis that they worry about. So this is something, I guess, of what will always be an imperfect relationship that we have, with a plethora of constitutional differences. In fact, their constitution is the Quran, and ours is not. So we are constitutionally at odds with one another. But now, where there are differences, we have the mechanism to discuss those differences. For instance, how to support Iraq, how to recognize it diplomatically, and it looks like they're going to establish an embassy. And that's a big change from just a couple of weeks ago when they said they would think about it, like they've been thinking about it for the last 2 years. This is progress, though. It's a good step forward. Or when they forgive Iraq's debt of billions and billions of dollars, or stop that flow of foreign fighters to the extent that they can't. The relationship is now positioned to withstand direct talks, and often out of those talks come good action. Secretary Rice said in August, if there are problems the United States has with Saudi policy, we talk about it. If there are problems that Saudi Arabia has with American policy, we talk about it. And with the prospect of Iran or of Iraq shifting more into the orbit of Iran, if that comes to pass, we will find much more to talk about with the Saudis. We will need to listen closely to what they say and our other allies in the region. This is a neighborhood that they know best. This is the way we proceeded when we restructured our bilateral relationship, listening carefully to what they had to say so we could strategically reposition. Now, as we are faced with more difficult decisions about Iraq, there's one thing that's very clear. It is imperative to help those who are our friends and our allies in the Middle East by those who feel threatened by Iran as it grows stronger in a now very changed but just as dangerous Middle East. I thank you tonight for letting me engage with you on this subject. As I close, I will say it was a terrific experience that Anita and I had representing you, our country, in Saudi Arabia at this most unusual time. We enjoyed it very much. We've been back in Dallas now for several months, just taking a breather before we kind of relaunch business. I love the private sector. And we have had the challenge of a lifetime and have enjoyed it thoroughly. So I thank you very much for your attention tonight. If we have time, I know it went on a long time, but if we have time, I'd be very pleased to take questions. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, Bob.
Could you give us a brief rundown of the military package that you referred to, what the Saudis are requesting?
The kinds of weapons that the Saudis have requested, not in specifics. They are generally described as defensive weapons. The desert heat takes a huge toll on things like airplanes and the dust. And, so they need to replenish their supplies pretty routinely. So it will be defensive mostly. JDAMs are being discussed with them. I don't know the outcome of that now that I don't have the reading material that I used to pore over to find out, the inside facts. I'm not sure exactly all of the weaponry, but mostly defensive in nature. Yes, Pat. Well, you're not supposed to answer a speculative question, but I'm not in the government anymore. the question is, in the Jerusalem Post and other places, Fox News now has, and a few other places, that plans are being made to bomb Iran. And the question is, well, what would be the consequences? Acute answer would be destructive, I hope. Of what they're trying to do in terms of their nuclear capabilities. During my time of service, I was privy to see information that was quite startling at the time, which I now find on the internet, that was secret at the time, but is no longer, such as this laptop computer that was that has fallen into the possession of the United States. Which vividly describes the kind of weaponry that the Iranians are trying to construct, along with the proper height at which it should be detonated. Now, these are real things I am absolutely convinced of it and believe with all my heart that the Iranians are dead set on achieving nuclear weapons, not just passive nuclear energy. The president is going to have, this president or the next, and there was a study that came out from the IIRS, which is a huge British outfit, an intelligence outfit, that achieves high marks for accuracy and for visionary thinking, that believes that the Iranians could achieve what they need to begin construct within, they said, at the end of 08 or 09, many years ahead of where the CIA had projected. So a president, sooner or later, is going to have to grapple with this. This is why we need to leave the diplomatic doors wide open and continue to pursue diplomacy for as long as we can to try to get their attention. This country, Iran, wants to be recognized as a great country. This is built into their psyche. They don't believe that they have that recognition now. It is my view that they believe they will get it if they can achieve weaponry, and that is a good part of what is driving them. So if we can find ways to address issues like that with them, and we've tried. The Europeans have worked on it for more than 3 years. And it now appears that the Security Council will not go for additional sanctions. Some of our closest friends, I'm not talking about China, I'm not talking about Russia, some of our closest friends, if the reports are accurate, have decided they will not go for additional sanctions. And of course, that's the way to go if you want to avoid a conflict. So the president, you know, already with so much on his plate, now has a lot of things to think about with respect to the Iranians. You can speculate endlessly about it. Their sites are spread out around the country. It's a huge country, mountainous country. There's no easy answer to any of this. Would it be a sustained bombing campaign? I can't begin to speculate. I was in the energy business, you know, and now we'll be doing other things. Typically, what happens when a country is hit is the people of that country come right together. And this is a time when Ahmadinejad is failing. The economy is really in shambles in that country. They're importing gasoline, for heaven's sakes. Hunter, Pierce, people are in the energy business. Can you believe it? I can't believe they're having to import their gasoline. Of course, we're importing a little oil here. So there's no good answer about what would happen. I know what would happen when we were hit. We came right together. And you know, that's not what you want to do with him in office. So if there are ways that you can work internally, those ought to be explored too. I don't mean trying to take them down internally, but trying to explain to people, you know, what the situation is. I don't know if that helps too much, yeah. Are there other questions, Stephanie? Yes,
Stephanie.
Absolutely. Come up here, Anita. Come on. Come on, Anita.
Oh, I'll just stand by you. Oh, I think it's a general rather than a specific. Oh, she's asking me what my fondest memory was of experiences that I had there. And I think rather than one, I had many fond memories, so it's hard to pick one. But I think the fondest thing that I had was when I met so many of the ladies, and they were so gracious and kind to me. And a lot of them had American experiences. But they went out of their way to share with me their lives, stories about their children, about their homes, about their families, and made me feel like I was actually a part of their families. So I was well received, and I think, and they told me a lot that I shared with Jim over the time that we were there. So I think in general it was just their graciousness and warm hospitality. They were so anxious to hear about a lot of things that we do in the country and what women are like here, the ladies that don't travel as much. The other ones travel a lot to the United States. So they were very happy to share their families and their lives. And I think that says something when you care enough to share personal things about yourself. So
One thing, you know, we didn't cover all the personal things. There's no way to do it. 3 years, for heaven's sake. Anita had to leave after we got there. After the first 3 months, I had to send her away. All the families had to evacuate. And so for 6 months, she was without a place. 3 months at the Watergate, 3 months at Cyprus so I could go see her. The one time I got there, we landed on the plane. The phone rang, and I had to get on the next plane back. So she went through a lot. This was a shared experience, I must say. And there were times that she got back at me, like when she would have the Saudi ladies over to Quincy House, which is our residence. Well, no self-respecting Saudi lady will be seen by a man, so they lower the blinds, and your ambassador found the back stairs to Quincy House on many occasions. I don't know how big a trouble I was in. I could not engage with the... yes, one here and then in the back there. The question is, you know, in the Islamic system of education, is it an anti-American process? I think the answer to that is no. It's more driven to the way they have proceeded over the centuries, which is an us-against-them mentality, generally framed within the religion rather than against the countries. And the relationship that the U.S. has had with Saudi Arabia since basically 1937, when the first oil finders got there, or whatever the year was, I think that's right, has been extremely positive. So I think they would not let that intrude into their official system. Now, outside it, of course, you know, we are labeled by a lot of people as the great Satans or whatever the words are that they want to use that day. But the Saudis have begun to retrain some of their imams, and they have begun retraining of some of their teachers who move off of the established curriculum into, you know, the intramurals of the world, body politic. And not officially, Pierce. It's not there. But as the foreign minister told me one time when I was on them about what's in their textbooks, they've made gradually some changes. It gets harder for them to make changes over the years. But he told me, he said, "Mr. Ambassador, we will change our textbooks. But what we really have to do is change the minds of the teachers." It goes beyond the textbooks, you know. So they're doing a lot of thinking about that and trying to take some steps. Yes, Dick, in the back. Well, what a question to end on, Dick. I think the summary would be, listen carefully to the people of the neighborhood. Take time to understand their essence. Understand the divisions within the societies that occur. Understand that lines in the sand that make countries really do not matter to people who have intermarried over eons or done nomadic treks one way or another. These things don't matter. View the Middle East as a piece of fabric rather than just as a place, because it's really stitched together in ways we don't understand. And if policymakers don't listen to knowledgeable people, they can make some very big mistakes. I think that's what I would tell him or her.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.